know the Gloucestercast, you know that. You know that intro. And we have the audio locked and loaded. We can fade out the intro music and we can introduce our illustrious guests. We have Heidi Dallin from Gloucester Stage. Heidi, what's your official capacity at Gloucester
Media
Stage?
Relations Director and Youth Program Director.
And the youth program, it seems like that has that gone to a new level? Because I don't remember it I don't ever remember it since the last couple of years or whatever, since it seems like you've been particularly involved. Has there always been one, or is it just, I'm hearing more about it because you're the media director as well?
Well, that is a good thing. So yeah. The kids always know they're going to be in the paper and on TV with me. But the youth program is only about 10 years old, which in the history of the theater is 36 years old. So It's relatively young, and it was something I believed in because I was a kid growing up in Gloucester, and I loved theater, and there was no place to go. I had to leave town for it. And I thought, well, we have this fabulous professional theater, and the one segment of the population we're not reaching out to is
youth. You want to bring them in.
And it's been terrific. We do a holiday show in December.
I know Alicia DeWolf's kids involved.
Talia is my assistant.
Yeah.
Talia started with me when she was about 10 years old. And it's very funny because she says, Heidi, I've learned so much about theater, because the kids not only learn about acting, they learn about directing, they learn about stage makeup. They learn about set design. They learn about lighting. They learn about television production.
It's really the future of the theater. Some of those kids will run the theater at some point.
And that's kind of probably the thought process behind having the program.
Yep.
It's kind of like an initiation. I should speak to the voice of the sexiest, the sexiest, most handsome 78-year-old man I think I've ever.
I'm only 76.
You lied. You just see your assistant over here. She told me 78.
See, he looks even better, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, handsome man. So what's the secret to keeping your appearance and looking so healthy?
Nectarines.
Nectarines? I don't know if I even said his name yet. Israel Horowitz is with us.
Horowitz.
Did I say V?
Said Witz. That's the pianist.
No, okay.
His name's Vladimir with a V. I'm Horowitz.
Horowitz.
Like Wagner with a no, what am I talking about?
That's really confused people.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're looking great. I just want, after the podcast is over, we're going to go over a few life lessons of how I could potentially look that good when I'm 76.
Some years ago, I was really close with Paul Simon, the composer, and we used to go to parties and play a game called Pulling a Compliment. And you go up to a complete stranger and you say, I don't know what it is, but all day today, people have been telling me I really look good. And then be this hideous, embarrassed pause, and ultimately the person would say, well, you do look good. And you go, okay, that's one for me.
Very nice.
It worked the room.
Very nice. I love it.
But yeah. I didn't set it up today. You just volunteered it.
No, well, that's right. It's true. I'm not a bullshitter. Right? Am I a bullshitter?
It's true.
Let's just say I look good for radio.
Well, maybe you scrubbed up so much because you thought this was going to be a video podcast.
Exactly.
And so, yeah, all the barnacles are off, clean shaven. And
I did an interview on the radio with a cast of one of my plays. And we were doing radio show after radio show. And for some reason, I don't know why I thought it was funny, I said, what your listeners don't know is that we're all sitting here completely naked. And it turned out that it was a Catholic radio station.
Just like that.
In fact, it was crazy than that. There was a room full of people just praying that came there every day. And anyway.
Silence. Radio silence for about 10 seconds after that, I imagine. We have Kim Smith with us.
Good morning, Gloucester.
And Toby Peck.
Good morning, Gloucester.
There you go. That rounds out the cast. I'm Joey Shimitaro, your host. We're going to talk a little bit about Gloucester Blue, which is unbelievable. It opened after Labor Day, is that right?
It opened after Labor Day. That's a fact.
It's a fact.
It's a fact. It is a fact.
And not only did it, so it opened up after Labor Day, which is, you know, shoulder season, after, it's after the big, you know.
Well, we've been advised never to do a publicity. never to do the theater experts that come from the big cities say never do a play here after Labor Day because you're the center of your audience is
packed up and
is tourists, yeah, or what's the opposite of a snowbird, a sunbird, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I never felt that was in any way true because when we opened the theater on East Main Street, we had been at the Blackburn Tavern. We opened with a play called North Shore Fish that I had written about women fish packers.
Which, and we should say, that's the first time I met you. You were down here. I remember you walking into the office. The office at the time was downstairs. We had this oil burner that would be this, half the size of the office here. And you went to my dad. And you asked him for some real deal, the wooden fish boxes, which we used to use. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure I asked for something for nothing, because that's how the theater...
Yeah, pretty much. I remember that, too. And I remember the fact was, I just want to talk about it, because we had this little bit of a conversation earlier, and I don't want to let this slip by before we go on to the next thought. I saw that play, and... It was 85, 86?
I think it was 85.
85. Yeah. 85. Okay, so back then, I'm graduating from high school, and...
That's 30 years ago.
It was so surreal to me, because, you know, we're Italians. At the time, I hadn't gone away to college, so I was still kind of a townie. So you did this play, and it was about fish. We had a fish packing line here. We packed fish for A&P supermarkets, whiting, squid, and everything else. And to see the play and the themes and the dialogue and a lot of the plots that were running through the thing, it was so surreal, because to see what I would consider an outsider talk about our Italian like packing line heritage and to nail it so... It was so spot on. I mean, it was something else back then. I really wasn't a child of the play. I wasn't a child of it. I was a downtown Gloucester kid. Went to the YMCA and hung out with my Italian cousins, and we played Pee Wee football. And went to my grandmother's house afterwards. But I grew up 9 years old on here at the dock in the packing lines of 50 women, dating within the ranks and all this other stuff. I mean, I don't know how, you're really an outsider, what was the process to understand these underlying themes? Like, as a Jewish guy from Wakefield, but really, you know, at this point you had been all over the place.
See, I'm an outsider everywhere. In that sense, I'm probably less of an outsider here than any place else on earth.
But, not New York City?
Everybody's an outsider in New York City. Who's an insider in New York City? I mean, that's a city that is in constant motion and is always looking for something new. And I mean, people do their jobs. People go to offices. People run fish plants. People do whatever people do. All I do is watch people. That's my job.
Yeah, but inside a fish plant.
Yeah, like, you remember Gail Randassa? The first thing I knew, I saw photographs of women in a fish plant, and more importantly, I could see Gloucester changing. I could see my neighbor Jack McKinnon was head lumper, and there was he told me there was a time there were 1,200 lumpers. And at the point he told me that, there were 15 lumpers. And the lumpers, the union, and my dad was a truck driver when I was growing up and went to law school at night and he became a lawyer. But all through my childhood, he was a truck driver. And I worked on jumping up and down on bales of paper in a bailing press in my uncle's shop in Stoneham when I was like 9 years old for $2 on Saturday. So I could see a change in, not just a change in working class life, but a change in respect for working class life. And I had a mentor and a wonderful writer, an old writer called Thornton Wilder, who wrote Our Town and created the best loved town, small town in America called Grover's Corners. And of course it never existed, it all came from his imagination. And he once told me, if you write about a place and you get it right, you don't have to write about the world, because people are people. So everyone around the world will respond. And North Shore Fish has been done all over the world. And when it's done in Germany, people think it's very German. When it's done in France, it's very French. When it's done in Gloucester, however, it's very special, because that's the place I'm writing about. But all I do is watch people behave, listen to people talk, and try to make it apply. And Gloucester Blue is North Shore Fish was 1985, and it went to New York directly. It was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize when it left here, and it's really been done all over the world. But the problem hasn't gone away. The change hasn't gone away. And from my point of view, I see not only the loss of respect for working class people in Gloucester, which is to say around the world, but I also see a newfound respect for very acquisitional people, for hedge fund people, for, you know, money. I see McMansions going up around Gloucester that I don't understand why people need houses that big. It's extraordinary. And I also see, again, I'm talking about Gloucester, but I'm talking about the world. But I'm only writing these plays about Gloucester. I see Gloucester kids who don't go to Harvard, who don't come from educated families or wealthy families. I see them falling in love, getting married, and unable to buy a house in a town where their families have lived for generation after generation. They just can't afford to buy a house. So where do they go? They can't even afford New Hampshire. The joke used to be you go to New Hampshire, but you keep going, keep heading north. So there's plenty to write about, and my job is to get it right, is to not overdo it. Gloucester Blue is a play in which two local guys of questionable character are restoring or renovating a loft downtown overlooking the harbor that's been boarded up for years and years, and it's an enormous building. I won't tell you which building it is that I use, but
I won't know which one.
I had something real in mind, so when I was directing the play and they'd say Eastern Point, I'd say point that way because it's there, you know. And anyway, they're renovating this place for very, very, very wealthy people who've bought this derelict building for $800,000, and let's say they're going to put $1.4 million into it, and they're going to use it for a summer house, but they're not really going to live in it in the summers. It's going to house a collection of something that they have. So these two guys who are working to renovate this place, when they discover what it's cost and its use, essentially you're saying, what planet am I living on? Let me tell you this story. Back in North Shore Fish days, I was doing another play at the Universalist Church, rehearsing at the Universalist Church. They used to give us the basement to rehearse in. I came out of the building and I looked at, there was a block of three houses for sale. Three Victorian houses. They were all derelict and they were boarded up and they were for sale at the same time. Maybe you remember it. And I'm looking at the houses and I think, why do they look so familiar? And I had just seen an Edward Hopper exhibition in Paris. And I went to my Hopper book, and there are the houses. So I did a little research. The houses, the three houses at that point, a long time ago, you could buy the three houses for $260,000 for the three, for all three. The painting at that point had just sold for $1,300,000.
What a story.
So you can see the irony. The story's not over. That painting just resold for $40 million. And the little intern, Avery, who's, she's not little, she's a very bright young woman, who's also works with Heidi, I set her on that track to do the research for, and she was the one that discovered it had sold for $40 million. So then we tracked at the same time, so that's what the painting of the house, then we tracked what those houses would sell for now, and what a house painter's income would be then and now, and what a plumber's income would be. And it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. Again, I'm presumably just writing about Gloucester, but it's the world. Wherever I go in the world, people are, you know, experiencing the same thing.
So the question I have is, do you have the theme in mind first?
Yes.
And then you build the story around the theme?
Yes. I mean, when you're a kid and you're starting out, especially when you're a truck driver's kid from Wakefield, you know, this whole thing is a miracle. It's not like I wasn't born to this. When you're a kid, it's all me, certify that I'm a writer, you know, just me, look at me. And at some point, if God is kind and your plays get done, your work gets seen, you start to think, what does the audience need? Because I'm dicking around with their babysitter money, their time. I better have something to say. And they're going to jobs, and they're going through a different kind of life. I'm just watching people. And so, yes, at this point in my life, what an audience wants and what an audience needs may be quite different. Mm. So it's my job to find a balance. So Gloucester Blue has, like North Shore Fishes, serious themes, but it's also very funny and very entertaining. That's my job.
But also, obviously, it resonates because I don't think we finished the thought on it opened after Labor Day, but you're extending it, which right. not only did you
break the rule
of opening after Labor Day, in quotation marks, but it resonates so well.
And it's full. The theater is packed with people. I don't know about the extension. I don't know how many people know it.
You don't have to paper the house.
So for your listeners, it runs through October 11th. Please show up this week and know that we've extended the play. But we opened after Labor Day, and we've been playing to full houses, and they're not tourist houses. They're local. They're local people, or they're people with a very strong connection to Gloucester. Mm-hmm. And they're responding extremely well.
Well, that's fantastic to hear, and hopefully you have the same success as you had with North Shore Fish. Can we talk a little bit about your connections with Gloucester and stuff like that? Is that all right with you?
Well, my parents used to take my sister and me to Gloucester on special days. That was our treat.
From Wakefield?
From Wakefield.
Growing up
yeah.
in Wakefield?
Yeah.
Okay.
My father, he had these small trucks that could hold 8 bales of paper. So he owned 2 of them, and he would truck the paper up to the paper mills, and my relationship with my father growing up was always in the truck.
Work,
you know,
yeah.
work beside him in the truck. That was
like mine here.
Practically the only time he ever talked, you know, and then he woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning, he went to work, and
I don't know anything about these things.
So it's all familiar to you guys. So if you want to have a relationship with your father, you have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go to bed at 6 o'clock at night and listen to the radio. Ask me the question again.
How you came to Gloucester?
So that we would come here on special days, and I have the same kind of checkered past that everybody's got, I guess. When you try to get out of a town like Wakefield, and I ended up getting married when I was 17 to my pregnant 16-year-old girlfriend. There was no pact. And oh my God. So I finally got I wrote my first play when I was 17. It was put on in Boston. When I finally got to New York, I was scared to leave New York. I had a play called Indian Wants the Bronx with Al Pacino, and I was in my 20s, and it was a success, and it was his first play and my first play. Wow. And John Cazal from Winchester, who was Fredo in The Godfather, and Sal in Dog Day Afternoon. We were all kids. And I met an actor on the street, Bobby Christian, this wonderful actor, died young. And he was touring in a show. And I said, "What are you doing in New York? I thought you were on tour." And he said, we closed early. The critics killed us." I said, "Boston." He said, "Yeah."
Tough crowd.
Of course. Yeah. That would be your first guess. And he said, "Oh, you're from there." And I said, "Yeah." And "We've got a house up there that we paid for a couple, all the rent's paid for a couple of months if you want to use it," because I had 3 little kids then. And I said, "Where is it?" He said, "Gloucester." And it was over on Halibut Point. It was one of those houses that Janet O'Donnell's dad had built, you know, in the 50s or 60s. And as soon as I got here, I thought that I'm just going to be
this
here.
Is it?
Just
yeah.
It just fit in. It's a long time ago. And I rented houses. My first wife died. I had three kids of my own. I rented houses for 3-4 years, and then I found my little house up the hill here,
yeah,
from here, and it cost $38,000, and it's still my house. And it was a time when two Gloucester kids that got married could have bought that house,
mm, and be a creative.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And be a creative. Because, I mean, you talk about working people. I mean, you know, you could still maybe work, afford, but a creative's, as a young creative, and really don't have your, haven't had your chops yet, or, you know, then really difficult to afford to live around.
Yeah. We bought our house in the 90s, and that, because that was our choice to move from Boston to Gloucester, because we could afford a house in Gloucester, mm, at the time, being two creatives. That wouldn't be the case today.
Oh, no. It would absolutely not be the case. I mean, it's there's an interesting play to be written about that still.
Yeah. I mean, my family house, my father bought for $3,000.
Well, that's anyone in any town in America.
My parents bought, we had a summer house, he called it, in South Hamilton. It was next to the swamp. You could watch the mosquitoes bite the other mosquitoes. And
probably
he bought it for $1,200, and it was kind of on stilts, and we finished it off. And we used to literally pack everything we owned onto his truck and drive 20 minutes down the road from Wakefield, from our winter house to our summer house, and we set up there. And I caddied at Myopia, which figures into the play Gloucester Blue quite heavily. So suddenly, I would show up at Myopia in the morning and to caddy, and there'd be people on the porch in suits and ties and long dresses, 9 o'clock in the morning. You could hear the men say to the women, their wives, the old guys, and they'd say, "Is it too early for a drink?" You know, 9 o'clock in the morning. It's like,
I just found out they have a game called Paddle. Do you know what Paddle is?
Sure.
I never even, 2 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that a game named Paddle even existed.
I can tell you, there's a game on in Annisquam that they've been playing for years, throwing a ball against a rock on the beach.
See, all the swells in Annisquam can tell you that story too. Yeah, that's wild. So tell me the story about the cream colored, is it an MG?
My car?
No, the Fiat.
Oh, Fiat.
It's a Fiat Spider that we bought.
Did you buy that new?
We bought it new in 1978 or 80, whenever it was. I did a movie called Author.
Right.
And I got a
over here on Cripple Cove. You Benjamin Smith Playground. We shot the ice skating.
And with
Erwin Winkler was the producer.
Wow, Toby.
Well, we bumped into each other in New York at, you remember, United Artists. What are you doing here? When my friend Judy ran part of that operation.
I brought Erwin Winkler, had produced Rocky, Raging Bull. Right. He was enormously successful producer. And I brought him to Charlie's place for chowder. And then he liked to swim. He used to swim every day at the New York Athletic Club when he was in New York and someplace in Beverly Hills. So I brought him down to the Y. And do you remember Carol? She used to waitress at the Raven. She was a local Italian girl. She was beautiful, and she was at the pool, walking at the end of the pool, and I shouldn't maybe say this on the radio, but two guys when I was there, because I never swam, and so I took Winkler, and two guys were looking at her, and they swam into the. To the end of the pool. And they had to be taken out of the pool. One guy was bleeding.
Oh, that's funny.
She was beautiful. She probably still is beautiful.
There you go. That's funny. So I was reading a little bit. I went through Internet Movie Database and stuff like that. I didn't realize your daughter Rachel was involved with one of my top five favorite movies of all time.
About Schmidt or Moneyball?
No, neither.
Wow.
Rushmore.
No kidding.
Rushmore. I love the dialogue in Rushmore.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Is
Wes Anderson.
unbelievable. It's one of it's so great. I almost feel like it was just my story growing up because I was an awkward kid that was very involved with Bishop Fenwick and, like, you know, couldn't. But, like,
she has a wonderful movie opening tonight in the New York Film Festival. She got a new movie that she produced called Maggie's Plan, and it was written by Arthur Miller's daughter, Rebecca, and directed by Rebecca. And it stars Julianne Moore, Ethan Hawke, and Greta Gerwig. And it's called Maggie's Plan. It's great. I've seen it a couple of times.
How much time did your kids spend in Gloucester?
Well, Matthew and Anna went to Rusty's camp. Springfield and my grandchildren go to my son Matthew comes back usually when I'm not here, and his kids go to Spindrift,
hang out they
then they go to the Y.
Yeah.
And no, my kids are Oliver, my son Oliver, who is caddying in St. Andrews today in the Dunhill for Huey Lewis. He caddies for Huey Lewis every year in that tournament. He's a big golfer, and he was four-time junior champion in Rockport and three times at Bass Rocks. He's a junior player. So I would say, you know, there's a real heritage. I mean, my family is very involved with Gloucester. And
my first concert I ever went to, a sophomore in college, was a Beastie Boys concert. And I'm going to tell you, this is crazy. So we drove out, it was at the Worcester Centrum. Two of my other buddies drove up in my old Cutlass Supreme, 1976 Cutlass Supreme, to the skin, bologna skins for tires. In the middle, I think it was in the middle of the winter, and out of the middle of the stage, like a 9 foot wide, 20 foot tall.
Oh, I know the concert. Penis.
Penis. blow up inflatable penis, erects in the middle of the stage. And you have to, this is my first concert I've ever been to. I had no idea what, you know, concert experience was supposed to be like. You know, a huge, you know, our generation grew, we were the first rap, you know, generation growing up and stuff like that.
Can you imagine the ordeal in my family keeping my mother, his grandmother, away from that concert? And then, but that's a perfect example of what I was talking about before, because those kids morphed into very socially conscious young men, and they raised more money for the Tibetan cause, and they became really
they're still relevant, making music. I mean, they're still relevant.
And these three guys become feminists, and they start from that place that was the American boy. And they were obviously speaking for a hell of a lot of American boys, because they became very, very popular.
You know, Adam performed at Gloucester Stage.
Is that true?
Yeah. When he was 12, yeah. He did a fundraiser. He did a rap for
Blackburn. He did former...
That too, yeah. And he was in the first play we produced. He was a 12-year-old kid. It was called a play of mine called Former One-on-One Basketball Champion.
Amazing.
At the Blackburn Tavern.
And he used to sweep floors. He was a PA.
And I remember Carolyn Clay in the Phoenix writing a review saying he will have a career... This kid is going to have a career as big as his father's, and she got it so wrong, because it's so
right, absolutely, yeah. He's good, man. Yeah, right.
I was in Paris. There was an art show that everybody was saying great, and it was on a bridge called the Pont des Arts. You got to see it. And I went there, and it was nothing special, but I looked down from the bridge, and I see there's a barge. They call them péniches that people live on in the Seine. And this one was a theater, and there was a poster, and I was sure it was from my play Widow's Blind Date, not because I could read the title, but the image was. So I went down, and by God, it was my play. And it's a play about guys making bales, and it's a real down and dirty Massachusetts play. We've done it twice here. And so I introduced myself to the guy, comes running out. He says, "No, the show started." I said, "No, I'm just the Ochovitz." He went, "No, c'est pas vrai." He couldn't believe it. And so he takes me on, and there are 35 people in this barge, and they're watching my play. I watch for about 10 minutes, and I think, whoa, this is a measure of success, to have a play on a barge in Paris. So I ran to the bridge, because in those days I did a fairly long run every day. And so I say goodbye I don't want to watch the whole thing. I say goodbye to the guy. He walks me out to the little gangplank, and and I run down the river to Bercy, and there's a it's a piece of Paris, and there's a big football stadium called Bercy Omnisport, and they do concerts, they do stadium concerts, and there's a huge electric sign that says the Beastie Boys are coming the next week. 35,000 seats. I have 35 seats. So I call him up and I tell him, he said, "Dad, it's the same thing. You only need 1,000 barges in the river."
That is tremendous. That is great. Oh, my Lord. Yeah. Very, very successful family. I see, you know, so when I'm looking at your bio on the Internet Movie Database, no, it's a Wikipedia page, sorry. You know, you talk about, you know, you see your body of work in film, and but so was there ever a time where or was it always going to be the stage for you? Because, you know, you'll come back, you know, it's always, it seems like more your body of work you're known for and everything else is more the stage, by far away the stage.
I think Gloucester Stage Company had a big assist in that, in defining that, because I did a couple of films, and I wrote a bunch of films because that's how I fed my kids. But then I was hired to direct a film, and I realized it was going to take 2 years before I'd see the film, and that would be fast. And I thought, do I really want to spend 2 years of my life with this film? Because at that point, I was writing at least a play a year. Hmm. And when Gloucester Stage was cooking, and I was really active with it. If I wrote a play, I put it on. It was that simple, right. And I could.
You had more control.
Yeah, I was running the theater, and my plays sold tickets. So it wasn't that I was doing a bad thing. It was a good thing for the theater. I wasn't every play wasn't mine. I'd do one a year, but I could write a play and put it on before I forgot why I wrote it. It was not just relevant to society, it was relevant to me, and movies, I would do work on a movie and it would, you know, I'd see it sometimes 3 years later and I couldn't remember why the hell did I write this thing, you know. And so I was hired to direct a movie and I quit it, and it was called Speed is of the Essence. It was right after the Strawberry Statement. Are you old enough to remember? No. The Strawberry Statement was about student strikes at Columbia, and it was we won a prize at Cannes Film Festival, and then I was hired to direct this drug movie about a young guy who gets a amphetamine addiction. It was a very serious movie, and I just didn't want to give it 2 years, and I wrote a play instead, and we put the play on, and I just thought, this is better, and I also, there's something about the live actors in the live audience that just, I mean, come to Gloucester Stage and see Gloucester Blue and you'll see what I'm talking about. We're packed with people, and this particular play, it's suddenly very tense and very dramatic, and the audience is quiet, and then it's undercut by comedy. It's like every emotion that you've ever had watching something. It was really something I experimented with, and that's I stand there every night and I watch the audience watching my play, and I'm 76 years old. My first play was put on when I was 17, and it's no less thrilling now than it was then. Yeah. And so how lucky am I?
When you can make a living doing something that you're passionate about, money is secondary, isn't it?
I think I can stay passionate about it because I'm not just writing for myself. I feel like this is good.
You still live in the $38,000 house, the first house that you hadn't lost?
Yes, it's big enough. I love it. I mean, my wife just said to me this morning how much she loves the house.
Right in the heart of God's country, East Gloucester.
It's beautiful. We've got a little acre of land. We have a lot of trouble with it.
There's an acre there?
There's an acre. It's mostly it's mostly sledge. We got this big rock in the back that's about a third of an acre. I bought the house. I'm looking at the rock and I hear the real estate lady say to me, "And you will own the rock." So I turn to her and I say, "Who's going to tell the rock?"
Oh my God! When you were in New York, spending time in New York, David Mamet, Did you guys run in the same circles at all?
Well, I was doing a play. Diane Keaton did a play of mine in New York called the Primary English Class that we've done here a couple of times. And I went out to Chicago to do one of the Wakefield-based plays called Our Father's Failing. And the first night I was out there, my lung collapsed. I was running a lot. I wasn't eating well. I weighed 128 pounds. And I guess that's the profile for collapsed lungs. And something burst. Anyway, I was in a hospital in Chicago for 45 days. It was no joke. And I was on a machine, and I didn't know what. I remember writing to writers that I knew, saying, if I die, take, you know, I want you to look into my children. And Samuel Beckett wrote back and said, I'll take the girl.
That's funny.
And anyway, there was a kid that came and visited me every day in the hospital in Chicago. And just before I left the hospital, he gave me his play to read. And it was American Buffalo. It was David Mamet. And he was just a kid in Chicago. So
holy mackerel.
It's a small little world, really.
Yeah. Oh, he's got one of my other top five movies. The one with Lindsay Krause and
House of Games.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, she was good. She just did a reading of a new play of mine we're going to do next year.
And actually, Lindsay's doing a fundraiser
for Gloucester Stage
on November 1st. We're doing Love Letters. And Lindsay and Joel Kolodner, who Joel starred in Sweet and Sad earlier in the season, which was one of the Apple Family plays that we did in collaboration with the Stoneham Theater.
He did something of mine on television.
Joel?
35 years ago.
Oh my gosh. Didn't know that. He lives in New Hampshire, and everyone loved him in Sweet and Sad, but we love Lindsay at Gloucester Stage, and she hasn't been here. She hasn't been able to be here this season. So
it's nice that every once in a while she'll pop in and do a play.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, we're so happy to have her do this fundraiser. It's going to be a great night. There's going to be an auction. You're going to be able to have cocktails backstage at the theater.
No.
The shop.
All the swells will be there.
In the shop. No, it doesn't have to be the swells.
Just teasing.
Her father spent a lot of time in Gloucester, and he wrote My Fair Lady when he was living in Gloucester.
Oh, when he wrote it while he was here?
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's pretty interesting. See, all these things, I think there's probably been like 15 things that I found out.
Lindsay's father?
Over Locks of Cove.
No, Lindsay said no, it was Sound of Music he did.
Sound of Music, sorry.
Sound of Music.
Roll back.
And you know, Lindsay, his partner was Russell Krause and Howard Lindsay.
Exactly.
They were partner and Krause.
And that's why her name is Lindsay Ann Krause.
Yeah, it's lucky it's her. For her father's partner wasn't like Schwartz or Goldberg, because she would be.
I have a question.
Oh. Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for coming. Is there anything you want to add? Well, do we have the dates of how it's extended to, where people can get
Gloucester
the information?
Blue runs through October 11th, and performances are Wednesday through Saturday at 7:30.
Wednesday night, you're getting people in the house.
Yeah.
Dang.
Yeah, we had over 100 people this past Wednesday night and
Packed
Thursday.
Houses. So get to the website, I imagine.
Yep.
Lock down your tickets.
GloucesterStage.com, or you can call 978-281-4433. Annika is in the box office.
People still do that?
People still call.
People don't get on the interwebs?
People like to call. And, you know, computers aren't always right when it comes to things.
I'm an idiot like that. That's the way I think.
That's great you guys are doing this show.
Well, thank you guys for coming. I really appreciate your time.
Okay.
Have a great day, guys.
Thank you.
Bye. All right, we're not going to pimp Brothers Brew right now because...
We just did.
Oh, we just did that. Inadvertently, I just did, didn't I? No, Brothers Brew makes great donuts. Kim, thank you for bringing the donuts from Brothers Brew, which they were so generous to. Oh, no, they didn't comp you for these?
Oh, you paid for these? Yeah, but they don't know.
We mentioned them on the podcast all the time. They didn't comp the donuts.
I'm
sure they're very delicious, though.
They didn't know I was.
They're not as sweet as they could have been.
Exactly, Mark Ray. Thank you.
They did not know I was coming here. I get them all the time, bring them to friends. So, you know, they were very sweet, but they were not as sweet as they could have been.
Because if they were comped, they would have been that much sweeter.
No, I'm only teasing. No.
I kid. So that was a really nice piece.
That was awesome. Horowitz, not Horowitz. Right, I remember that.
Horowitz with a V.
Right.
And Heidi Dallin.
Right.
There was probably 15 points that or things that he brought up that I had no idea about that were amazing.
I think we should have him every Sunday.
I would like to have him in here. I think one of my favorite stories. Did he talk about this during the podcast when he was in France and he looked down over the bridge and there was on a barge he saw the poster for one of his
plays. He couldn't read the image on the poster he recognizes.
So then he was running and he ran down the street about 35 yards or something and he saw it, a huge billboard on the stadium, the soccer stadium where the Beastie Boys is playing to 35,000.
And his son, that was an amazing story.
And so he called up his son and his son Adrock. And said, "Oh, Dad, all you need is 35 more,
a thousand
more barges, and then you'll have the same kind of a show." That was awesome. Yeah, and the David Mamet story,
that was tremendous.
Jesus Christ! I mean, the guys, man, and he lives right up the hill.
Right
up the hill, I can hit his house with a rock.
He's in our hood.
No, with a slingshot, I can hit his house. So that was very cool.
Yeah, it's a small world, is the answer.
Yeah, well, when you got such a worldly guy like that, too, it's a really small world. Because his branches and his spider web goes out. He casts a very large web. Yeah. Toby, you wanted to talk a little bit about Lobster Land?
Go ahead. Well, I went to Lobster Land this week for lunch. They do a great job there. They execute it.
What did you get?
The Rust Island Club. Which is their hamburger club, a cup of fish chowder. One thing they do there, they offer both options, fish and clam. A lot of places, it's only one or the other.
That and Hollow Point.
They offer both and a Guinness on draft, which is also a key component to that wonderful lunch that I had. It's part of the reason to go there. And, of course, it's a beautiful space and Corey and company, his staff, do a fabulous job.
All right. Plug in for Passports. I went there twice this weekend. Brought the kids yesterday. They have Passports has this awesome kids
menu.
It's like under $7, I think.
And really? There's five or six different
options, and they serve the kids a popover, and the kids love the popovers.
Right, gets them going right away.
Why don't you say it so you don't have to correct me when I say it improperly?
Look, it's generally referred to as alla Tijana, but it's carne de porco, which only means pork meat alla Tijana.
Which is a Portuguese dish, and they have like the gardenia and the jardiner. I don't know how you say it, but it's that, and it's very salty, but it's delicious. The broth, had a loaf of Italian bread.
Is he going to have that all winter? Because that looks so
special.
Good.
It wasn't on the menu yesterday, because I went back the second day for it, and it wasn't on the menu yesterday.
He did not put it on this summer because it takes so long to make it. It's got a little bit of spice to it, and most people on a hot summer day, that's not the dish they're looking for. Yeah. But now that the weather's changed,
hopefully.
Boom.
Ooh,
yeah.
Boom.
So how about you? Any restaurant plugs?
You know what? I'm trying to think. I didn't bring any topics. I was so excited about Israel and Heidi coming. So I'm sorry. I'm totally blank on topics.
You're bringing so much to the table today.
I'm sorry.
She did bring the donuts. That could have been sweeter, but...
Listen, all week long, I've been working on landscape jobs and editing, and I'm happy to say I'm in the final stages of editing.
I feel like I've been hearing this for 2 years now. The final stages of the Monarch film.
No.
Sure, I think you might have got more out of that roll of paper towels.
So I'm just a workaholic right now.
Yep.
Sorry, it's not very exciting.
So I was very happy about, you know what I was very happy about yesterday. It was cold, sleeting, not really sleeting, but on the verge of sleeting. The rain was kind of coming sideways, and I didn't know if they were going to have my daughter Madeline's soccer game, and they ended up having it.
Ooh.
And I was really happy about this because I feel like, you know, kids are so coddled today. Everything's like bubble wrap around. Can we talk about the story about the community that banned tag because they said tag was too dangerous for the kids?
Yes.
Talk about helicopter parenting.
Okay, can I tell you a funny story about my son, Alex? Like, I would never know from my daughter, Olivia, that recess was canceled. Because she would be happy just going to the library. If recess was canceled, my son would come home crying. And he would say, "You can't believe it, Mom. The lunch ladies canceled recess because it was drizzling out. It was just drizzling. It wasn't even raining." I mean, he would be so angry because he just wanted to. He's a boy, and he had all that energy, and he just wanted to run around. He didn't want to, you know, didn't think that they needed to be coddled and, you know, not get wet when they're outside playing. You know?
I was so psyched that they played in that kind of rough and tumble weather.
And got muddy and dirty.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the parents were all, half or more of the parents were still in the cars. Oh. What are you doing? Oh. What kind of example is that for the kids? Right. Like, you expect them to play and you guys sit in the warm car?
You need to be out there.
What the hell is that?
Right. Agreed.
Yeah. No good.
Right. So. You're right.
Yeah. Parents are in their car playing with their smartphones.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Texting.
He's the mime and you're going to be the translator?
No.
Don't underestimate the fact that the lunch ladies were in cahoots with the janitors. Any drizzle, pay the lunch lady $20 to cancel recess, keeps the floors clean.
See, Mark Ring, he's five steps ahead.
It's
five
the oldest steps one in the
book. I'm sorry I couldn't explain that to my 5-year-old son back then.
That's the core.
I'll tell you, the kids today, though, we're going to go, should we do this? The kid today? So I was talking to this guy a couple of days ago, and he works in like an internet marketing company, and he's a young 32, something like that. And he was talking about the new hires that were all the 21-year-olds that just out of college that got hired. They went to the higher ups and demanded a meeting because they were very upset that their dry cleaning was not paid for by the company. It wasn't part of their benefits.
What?
So they
ridiculous. Totally ridiculous.
They organized and went to the higher-ups and demanded that they had their dry cleaning paid for.
That's so peculiar.
Because their buddy's company that they graduated with, their dry cleaners got picked up.
Oh, ridiculous.
Again. Show them the door.
Can you believe
this? Show them the door.
Well, no one can get anybody to work anymore. You know what it's like. Oh, yeah. I mean, like, so we have these, we have some awesome lobstermen. Like, they make money. These guys make money.
They're the top
10% of lobstermen landing-wise, money-wise. They have had the hardest time getting help. It's like, there's no one wants to. The kids, I don't know what it is. I don't know. Well, the economy is struggling so much because, you know, we're not going to go there.
Watch Fox News.
Yeah, Fox will tell you how terrible things are.
They'll see. Get in the closet.
Yeah, so anyway, I don't know. You guys got any topics you want to bring up?
Racking my brain.
Terrible.
I know, it's terrible. I didn't realize I was going to go beyond the Israel part.
Yeah. I think so. After this little weather goes by, I think the boats are, once they get going, I think we're gonna be off to the races. It's gonna be late nights down the dock.
Well, happy it's about for that. What 3 months?
Yeah, yeah. No, I know. So I can see the finish line. I can see.
Yeah, that's great.
It's there's a you know there's, the light is coming.
Right.
So got that going for me. Be able to enjoy a little winter time. Mark, anything going on with lobster fisheries you want to talk about? Any new meetings coming
up? Just waiting to get after it again.
Yeah. Oh. But what about the? So everybody should know. Mark is what's your official title with the Mass Lobsterman Association?
Oh, I'm on the executive board and a delegate.
On the executive board.
And you're in charge of the Fisheries Commission here?
Yes. Yes.
But so he goes to. So he has to go every third day. He's at a meeting for something or other.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a huge commitment.
But this is what I want to say about the Mass Lobsterman Association and the lobster industry as a whole. All the crying that you hear from the ground fishing industry, they never had a group. See, the Mass Lobsterman Association has always been proactive, lobbying to have regulations in place to protect their stock.
Right.
Unlike a lot of other fisheries. And they've done such a good job managing the stock that year after year, at the end of the year, when you look at the landings, at the, you know, they may come, the lobsters may come early, they may come in the middle of the part of the season, they may come to the end, or they might just have a steady season. You never know. But by the end of that season, when like January 1 rolls around and the lobsters stop moving, like the number of lobsters that get landed are, is unbelievably steady.
Wow!
It's a testament.
It's also not by accident that lobsters aren't under the control of National Marine Fisheries Service. They're under the control of an organization called the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. I believe if they had been under the control of NIMS for the last 20 years, we would probably be in a lot of the same mess that the groundfish boats are in.
There you go.
So we've been lucky in that respect.
Very interesting.
But so, Mark, what is it?
Which is 14 states. It's from South Carolina to Maine is the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. They manage a lot of the inshore stocks and stuff. Lobster's one of them.
Okay. Mark, can you explain for the listeners, what are some of the regulations that have been proposed by Mass Lobsterman Association that have that help preserve the stocks?
Well, I mean, we have the vents in all the traps. We have the bio vents that when a trap does get lost in time, that vent falls out so any lobsters that are in the trap can escape.
It's not ghost fishing.
It's not ghost fishing like it used to be. We were proactive in a lot of the whale-safe fishing gear as far as rope. We did a rope buyback. You can't even tie your buoys on with a knot anymore. You have to have breakaway buoys, so if a whale gets entangled, it will pull off, and hopefully the whale can get away on its own. So we did a lot of proactive stuff to stay ahead of the government, and the government's been happy with what we did more so than the green environmental groups. You're never going to make them happy because it's just more and more, and there's more and more whales repopulating, so there's bound to be more entanglements at some point. And they never want to see.
You're never going to hear. That. You're never going to hear that from their mouths,
right? And they consider every entanglement a death, even though the whale very well may be, get untangled and get away and be fine on its own. They still want to call that a take, which they consider a death. So, it's as much fighting with the green groups as it is the federal government.
Well, that's very interesting.
You just have to stay on top of it.
Huge very props to the Mass Lobsterman Association. They also do a lot for their membership. They have like, don't you guys have like a group insurance kind of thing?
Yeah, they own their own insurance company, which insures a lot of the boats, which is actually what drives the whole association. It's not the membership dues, it's the insurance company that actually, so it's more or less a co-op.
Wow, that's...
Yeah.
And going to the meetings gives you an excuse to go to Floramos.
Exactly, it's a night out for dinner. It's all about the dinner, it's not about the meeting.
But what a tremendous partnership. Yeah,
it works good. Yeah. Works good. A lot of work.
I can say
for a lot of people.
Yeah. It's a lot of work, and they're not getting like some big pay or anything like that. It's a volume of time and energy expended, but it's done as kind of like a labor of love for, you know, ensuring the future of this industry.
Can I ask Mark what your thoughts are about how the new proposal for the what do you call it?
The National Monuments with closing Cash's Bank and the Seamounts. Well, we're against it, and the hearings were last week in Washington, and it's been kind of quiet since that meeting last Tuesday. But it's the green groups trying to circumvent the usual process and trying to get Obama to rubber stamp this before he leaves office without it going through the usual avenues.
Usual processes.
If
it did become a national monument, that would be very impactful, right, to the lobster.
Yeah, to a lot of different fisheries. I mean, the offshore sword fishery uses it, tuna fishing, the heron fleet way offshore use it at times for the mackerel industry in the wintertime. And those three fisheries I just mentioned never even touch the bottom. It's all up in the water, pelagic fisheries, which has no effect on hurting the bottom of the ocean or anything else. So. We put a letter together, and it ended up being, I think, 11 different groups with 12,000 membership people attached to it that went to Washington, along with our congressional delegation and stuff. So we'll see how it goes, and hopefully it gets beaten down. It's just another, it's always one thing after another.
Now these types of groups, right, the Mass Lobsterman Association, like what, see, as people that are members, sometimes they need, what they need to have reminders of is that you may not be able to quantify, I received $400 worth of benefit from being a member of, because you can't, it's you in can't, the air, you know what I mean? Because they, these people are expending this energy, going to meetings, lobbying on your behalf. Right. But if you did not have this, the this organization, there are easily things that could get, you know, rolled right down over you with a stroke of a pen.
Right.
That isn't vetted or thought through because they don't, because politicians don't necessarily know the ramifications of it.
Right.
It's the same exact type of thing with the Chamber of Commerce and, you know, business, small businesses that if there's not a voice for them,
right, then they just get taxed.
It's like just mad. It's obvious. Right. Oh yeah. Well, where are we going to put this tax burden? It's easy to put it on the, you know, put it on the evil business guy. You know,
right.
No.
Right.
And so. You can't say enough for the people that populate these boards and stuff like that, because they're the ones volunteering their time for
the benefit,
the benefit of thousands.
Right, and just to add another layer to that, part of the issue is always the federal government is petrified of these green groups with bottomless pockets of money suing the federal government. So that's the other layer, as opposed to like the Chamber of Commerce dealing with individual business.
Yeah.
You're dealing with huge foundations that have,
and it's an easy sell. Pockets. It's an easy sell for them because there are people,
right.
and if anyone doesn't recognize this, that if you say, oh, we're gonna put up a solar panel or we're gonna put up a solar farm here, they say, awesome, you got to do it. You never mentioned how much it was going to cost, or, you know, or because you could say, if then what really should happen is, okay, how much is it going to cost and what can we expect to get as a return?
Right.
Their automatic response is, you have to do it.
Right.
Not,
right.
Oh, you know, because they could be, they say it's a scam and they're going to bill for $2 million and the maximum it could potentially even produce is $100,000. They didn't take that into consideration. They just said that all they saw was green energy. We have to do it, you know. So a lot of these initiatives, politicians don't want to get on the wrong side of them because they always want to be perceived as environmentally friendly.
No matter,
sometimes there's a costs involved that don't get taken into consideration.
Right? Just because it's environmental, just because it has the label environmental,
exactly.
Yeah. Doesn't
right. You still have to look into it. You still have to.
Environmentally green, but totally inefficient.
Right.
They'll go for the green every time.
A good portion.
Yeah.
Because it just, that's their ideology.
And the politicians are deathly afraid of opposing any of that.
Right, it's all about reelecting.
Oh my God!
Yeah, and with social media nowadays, you can create a big stir. Oh, this guy voted against this. he's against the environment. He's against seals. He's against, you know what I mean? Like, he paint you as a, you know.
Well, reading about the proposed national monument, I was thinking the ocean is so vast. Why can't they continue to keep the part that the fishermen are using open and make all the rest the national monument? You know what I mean? That just seemed like such a no-brainer to me, but I don't, you know.
Well, I mean, it's oil and gas money that's behind it.
That's the other side of the coin, yeah.
That's the green groups will use that.
That's their best friends.
As their reason to close it. It's not really the fishermen. We don't want gas exploration. But then if you dig deep enough into a lot of these foundations, they're funded by gas and oil money.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah.
So eventually they will be digging there for oil and gas. Yeah.
Probably. If it's there, they will.
Yeah.
Well, they won't have to pay off the fishermen to be able to access it.
You get your enemies out of the way.
Oh,
right.
My
you
get
them to clear them right out. Yeah.
Yes, it is an evil world that we live in.
Just gotta focus on the positive. That's it.
Ignorance
is bliss.
Right.
You know, like, I haven't watched the news. I can't tell you how. It must be a couple of years now. I have not watched the news. Ignorance is bliss. I swear to God. That's my thing. Anyway, that's another Glossacast
in the books.
Hey, Mark, thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
Bailey,
boom. Toby, Kim. regular cast. Israel Horowitz, Heidi Dallin. This is Joyce.
Horowitz.
It was awesome.
People make us...